AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. And it's Hotel Mars with David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show, my colleague and co-pilot. We are going into our time machine back to 1650 BCE, 3,600 years ago, on the eastern side of the Jordan River, north of the Dead Sea. We welcome Malcolm LeCompte. Malcolm is retired from the Center of Excellence in Remote Sensing Education and Research, Elizabeth State University in North Carolina. He's now a member of the Comet Research Group. You can find it at cometresearch.org. Most importantly, Malcolm is part of a team that have identified a strange event that happened at this moment in time that has left evidence behind that might be suggestive of stories in Bibles, but nonetheless, this is an event back then that could happen in any moment. Malcolm, a very good evening to you. A cosmic airburst over Tel al-Hammam. What happened that day, and what was on Tel al-Hammam that was damaged or destroyed? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening to you as well. Good to be here and good to be talking to you. It was a city, I would say, a quite large city for the Middle Bronze Age, probably as large as Troy, which was contemporary, and many other cities in the southern Levant. But Tel al-Hammam was apparently the largest of those cities. Population interior to the city was probably something on the order of 10,000 people, and probably many more surrounding in agricultural communities, smaller communities. So this was a significant city. And on that day, apparently coming in from the southwest, was a rather large bolide, we call them, that exploded somewhere above that area and essentially obliterated the landscape. The city walls were blown down. The people were apparently, most of them, I would guess, were instantaneously killed. And further afield, fire started, very much like the Tunguska event of 1908.
I need a definition. Bolide. What is that, Malcolm?
It's just a large meteorite of the order of a few meters in size, maybe even a little bit less. But they typically create a rather large, full moon brightness level burst in the air when they come into the atmosphere. So this was a big one.
And it forces the air down upon the city. What actually destroyed the city once the bolide hit the atmosphere? Did the bolide get through the atmosphere to hit the ground?
It got low enough to be significantly damaging to the surroundings, the surface. The bolide itself was probably about half the length of a football field or the width of a soccer field, and quite heavy, I'm sure. And the air pressure and friction would have heated it to the point where it could no longer hold itself together and essentially burst apart. And in that burst, it would have started a kind of a perfect storm of destructive circumstances. The first would be the brightness of the fireball, which would have been very similar to the sun, except that, you know, a matter of kilometers away instead of 150 million kilometers away. So you're going to be burning things instantaneously, setting them afire. And then there's a shock wave that occurs from that burst, which is at a very high velocity and probably reached Tel al-Hammam at about sonic velocities, strong enough to blow the wall, much, much higher than any tornado we've ever experienced. So able to blow walls down and just tear apart people. And then, of course, the whatever debris came with it that was excavated from the what we call the epicenter or the sub-burst point would have washed over the city in a hot, kind of similar to maybe a the flow of a volcano event, a volcanic event. There's a name for it. I'm having a senior moment, can't remember the name. But essentially a mass of superheated steam, debris, anything that was excavated by the plasma that resulted from the fireball that hit the earth would have excavated material and sent that toward the city, roughly in the direction that the fireball was coming.
David, you have a question for Mal.
In your excavations, have you found what you think might have been pieces of the asteroid, or how do you come up with the conclusion that this happened? What is the evidence for it?
Well, the temperatures that we're witnessing in terms of melted materials that have melting points that far exceed anything that we would encounter at that time. I mean, we can reach them with industrial processes today, although they're still quite high, even today. But getting over about 1400 Celsius is very difficult, especially at that time. And we find a lot of material that's heated much higher than that, into the 2000s. And that's the key indicator. That was our first big indicator, was seeing material, minerals and the elements that were melted. Now, some of those elements that are melted, iridium, platinum, those are typically associated with extraterrestrial events. But there is a distractor there, some of that could have resulted from trace elements, if there was, perhaps gold-flecked paint on the walls and the walls were destroyed. Some of that dust that was embedded in the paint contaminated the area. So that we believe we've got some extraterrestrial material, but there's no certainty to that. We just have the temperatures. And we also have something called shocked quartz and diamonds, very, very small pre-diamond structures, if you will. They're like pieces of diamonds that are the result of high heating and compression of carbon-rich material. And, of course, humans and vegetation would be the carbon-rich material that would be the source of that.
If I understand the report correctly, it not only destroyed this city but left the region without an ability to grow anything for hundreds of years. Is that correct, Malcolm?
That is correct. For about up to seven centuries is the estimate. I'd say anywhere from four or five to seven centuries is probably reasonable. And it looks like there's a salt layer that's in the soil that's contemporary to the date of the destruction. Now, how that salt got there is a bit of a mystery. We hypothesized that perhaps the detonation was over the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea was closer to Tell Al-Amam than it is today. That's a possibility, I suppose, but we really don't know how that mechanism worked. But nevertheless, the salt in the soil would have made it toxic to anything growing in the valley for some time until it was washed out.
David?
What continued evidence are you looking for? Because I understand you're doing new digs and exploring new parts of the area. So what are you looking for, and are you still working to confirm the hypothesis?
I think the hypothesis is on pretty solid ground. But there's continued work to be done, just because we really want to understand what the magnitude of the event was, if we can deduce its energy yield, that would be helpful. Because to me, the significance of the event is not the history, it's the future. It's how destructive are these events, because they will occur. These events will occur in the future. They're not that rare. It may be anywhere from a few centuries to a thousand or so years. But still, that's on a geologic time scale, that's very rapid, very, very frequent. But if they were to occur over a city, it'd be catastrophic, even today. Effectively, a nuclear bomb over the city would exhibit similar results. But the work that we want to do now is, we believe we may have found a crater, and that would kind of change the calculus of how much energy was released at the time, how much material. But we have to test that. We have to go there, collect samples, do whatever we can to understand if there's anything remaining of the impactor. So that's a major task to be done. And then the other thing that I think is very important to do is to collect samples from further afield. We don't know what the full extent of this was. We've got some indication that it affected surrounding villages and cities, but we don't really know yet because they haven't been thoroughly tested. And we'd like to do the same thing we did at Tell Alam at these other sites. Jericho, for example, there's a site to the north called Tell Namarin that's about 10 kilometers north. Jericho is about 25 kilometers or 20 kilometers to the west. So those are the two major. And then I'd be curious to know if archaeologists would embark on a quest to see if there's any mention of this civilization, because it's multi-communities going offline. It's a civilization that just goes offline overnight, effectively. And it'd be interesting to see if there was any indication that this was recorded in any other literate culture of the time.
Malcolm, would there have been any warning? We have about 30 seconds. If this happens again, is there warning?
Not for a 50-meter object. We don't have the capability to do that. 150, yes. 50-meter, no.
So it comes out of the night and you just disappear. That's what happened.
That's pretty much what happens.
Would the people have seen anything or they'd just be obliterated?
Anybody looking at it would be blinded by the burst itself. So they wouldn't have seen much for very long. And as far as the incoming, it would have been so quickly that they wouldn't have seen anything.
Yes, it's called extreme disarticulation. Malcolm LeCompte, who is now with the CometResearchGroup.org, David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contract. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.